Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show planned for you today. My guest will be Margaret Brown, who is a food law fellow at the NRDC, the Natural Resource Defense Council. And she'll be talking to us about the work she's doing on the regional food issues in the New York area and trying to get better food into our kids' schools. But there's lots of things going on in and around New York, and I want to share some experiences I've had this past week that were really awesome. So stay tuned for a really great show. Let's start by some of the things going on in and around the New York area. This weekend is a big weekend in New York. TEDx Manhattan is happening, Changing the Way We Eat. And there are viewing parties set up around the country. And if you can't make it to a viewing party, which is really a fun way to do it if you're not going there actually in person, you can also watch it live online. So either way, this wonderful event is available to you. But go onto the website, TEDx Manhattan, Changing the Way We Eat, and find out where there's a viewing party near you. There's one here on Long Island at the Cinema Arts Center, which we always partner with. It's like our sister organization. And there will be food, and, you know, it's in the cafe, so it's in a really nice, informative and socially convivial environment. So come on down to that and meet other people. You can come and go. It's free. Also this weekend, March 1st and 2nd, is the New York City Vegetarian Food Festival. That takes place at the Metropolitan Pavilion from 11 to 6, both days. And you can buy tickets, I think, right there when you go at the door. So you can also Google it, Vegetarian Food Festival, and maybe you can buy tickets online. I'm actually not sure. But it should be a good event. It's the fourth annual year. Also this weekend, Citizen Climate Lobby is having their Northeast Regional Conference. That's out at Stony Brook University. Great organization looking at climate change and, you know, coming up with a way that they feel we can really address climate change with this carbon points. So check that out if you're in that area. Also, there is a big protest going on this weekend in Washington, D.C. to protest the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, there's a real time element here where public can make comments on the Keystone pipeline. And I actually talked about that in my newsletter this week. The environmental impact statement that came out about the Keystone pipeline actually said that it would be okay to go ahead with it, that if we don't do the Keystone pipeline, the crude oil is still going to get transported through train rails, and those can derail and cause problems too. So since either way it's going to happen, why not do the pipeline? Really stupid arguments. They need to hear from everybody. I think March 7th is the deadline to let people know about that. If you go to my website at ieatgreen.com, there is a click on where you can sign on the letter and send a letter to Vice President Kerry to let him know that we don't want to go ahead with this because it's up to him right now, and then it goes to the President. So, you know, the Keystone Pipeline is really something that I've been fighting for, trying to get the word out for years now, and it's just unbelievable that our President can talk about needing to fight climate change, you know, at his national address, and then consider approving this pipeline. Just does not make sense. So please put your word in for that. And if you can get to Washington, D.C. This Saturday, you know, there's going to be a big protest. Also, March 2nd through 4th is the International Restaurant and Food Service Show, which is a fun place to go. It's at the Javits Center. Even if you're not in the restaurant business, it's really fun to go. So Think about that. Slow Food New York City is having an Urban Harvest Benefit Dinner. That's at the Rouge Tomato on March 3rd from 6:30 to 9. And it's an evening in honor of the National Nutrition Month. And it's featuring a seasonal five-course tasting menu. And you can get tickets for that at Slow Food New York City's website. What else is going on? March 11th to the 13th is the Whole Earth Summit, and that's online. And this is a great opportunity for all of us to get to hear from some of our real sustainable earth heroes. Vandana Shiva, Bill McKibben, Charles Eisenstein, Joel Salatin, the founders of the Small Planet Fund. Great people are going to be on. I think there's over 42 speakers between March 11th and 13th. It's called the Whole Earth Summit. It's free. It's online. And it's really going to be, you know, an opportunity to hear from some of our real great heroes. So check that out. And what else is going on? March 19th and 29th is the Long Island Community Agricultural Network presents organic gardening workshops. They're going to be taking place here in Huntington Station, St. Hugh's Learning Center, from 10 to 12, and they're being taught by some wonderful organic farmers, Larry Foglia and Heather Forrest, and those are March 19th and 29th. For more information, you can go to foxhollowfarm.org or .com. But just Google it. But it's really great if you are, you know, want to learn some techniques, learning about soil enrichment, succession planting, vegetable variety choices for productivity, and organic weed management. So they're just full of so much information. And then, of course, the Just Food Conference is coming up April 5th and 6th. Mark that in your calendars. Tickets are already on sale. So check that out. But I wanted to share with you where I was this week. I actually went down to Costa Rica to what was called the Envision Festival. And the Envision Festival, you know, people that are organizing this festival and many other festivals like it, I think get their inspiration from the Burning Man genre. But they take it, you know, to another level in that they are supporting everything that, you know, IE Green is about. They're supporting organics, they're supporting sustainable agriculture, they're supporting community, they're supporting eating well. I went to this festival and I was so impressed. I mean, there were, you know, there was not a lot of drugs, which I was concerned about. there was not a lot of alcohol. As a matter of fact, they had a couple of bars, but they didn't even open till 7 o'clock, and I remember one time I was so hot I wanted a beer, and I couldn't get a beer. You know, it was just really nice. So there was no one walking around drunk or anything like that. Instead, people were doing meditation, yoga, tai chi during the day. Great food available. People just, you know, lots of places to sit down and just talk with each other. You know, pillows everywhere around the food court. A huge, you know, center to the food court was a huge tea counter where you could pick any kind of tea you wanted. They did also serve coffee, but it just, you know, the whole place, there was a, you know, actually a tea ceremony area. The whole place just oozed goodness and sustainability and thinking. I mean, they had all the garbage sorted out for cans, bottles, trash, compost, and everybody was doing it. I didn't see one piece of trash on the ground. You know, it was a real no impact. They asked everybody to bring their own plates and silverware. If you forgot your plate, you could purchase, you know, somebody was weeding banana leaves together to make plates. Other people were selling pieces of bamboo that they had cut to create plates, and they looked like, you know, little sushi, long, thin sushi plates. They were beautiful, and people were putting their food in that. It was just really great. So, or if you forgot your cup, you know, they rented the cups. You could get your tea in a bamboo cup. And then when you brought it back, you got your money back. It was just really run beautifully. Most people, I guess, were camping. There was lots of tents, but then lots of people stayed in local hotels as I did. And the parking area was like 10 minutes away from the event. And once you parked, you had to get into a truck like cattle. I mean, it was funny. People were mooing as if we were cows, getting on this cattle truck and then being transported to where the festival was. So there were not a lot of cars coming and going from the festival at all. The only way to get in and out was through these shuttle trucks. And that really, you know, kept the traffic down. And it was just really beautiful. And for me, it was really wonderful not only to see my daughter perform there. That's why I went, because she was dancing and singing at this event. And there were so many performers, and the music was great. I mean, I didn't even talk about that. But the part that just really resonated with me was that there's these ongoing festivals, you know, a whole circuit of them that go on continuously throughout the year, that are bringing people together and educating people and supporting the ideas. And what's beautiful is that a lot of these young people are creating businesses around these different sustainable models, and they're supporting each other in these businesses. You know, the person that was doing the printing was staying at the same hotel as I was, and he does the printing for many of the musicians that were there, and he did the printing for the Envision Festival. And so they're supporting his printing company, but he gives back, you know, 1% to a nonprofit organization or cause of the choice of the customer. So the customer gets to pick where they'd like their 1% to go to. And so it's just really, you know, everybody helping everybody. And that was the sense that I got. And it just was, there was a camaraderie there that was really special and left me really hopeful for our future. So anyway, just wanted to share that with you. I also want to share with you, of course, my recipe this week before I invite Margaret Brown on to share with us her story. So this recipe is black bean and rice croquettes. They're actually similar to the veggie sliders that I had made for the film and food festival that we had a few weeks ago at the Cinema Arts Center. But these black bean and rice croquettes are great. I serve them with a mango salsa. You can also make a pineapple salsa, or you can just put them on a roll with, you know, ketchup and pickles, and they're delicious that way too. Okay, so I'm going to start with 2 cans of Eden organic black beans. The reason I say Eden is because there's no lining in their cans, and they also put kombu in with their beans, which helps the digestion of the beans. So if I have a choice of buying Eden brand organic beans, I do. 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1 onion diced, 3 carrots diced, 2 tablespoons garlic minced, 2 stalks celery chopped, 1/2 yellow pepper diced, 4 mushrooms chopped, 2 tablespoons tamari, that's a wheat-free soy sauce. And I always use tamari as opposed to shoyu or soy sauce so that my products or my food is gluten-free whenever possible. 1 teaspoon dried thyme, 1/4 cup fresh parsley, 2 tablespoons sesame seeds, 2 cups cooked short grain brown rice, 3/4 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon oregano, 1/2 teaspoon chopped rosemary, 1/4 teaspoon fresh ground pepper, 1/2 teaspoon cumin, and 1/4 cup of gluten-free breadcrumbs. You could use regular breadcrumbs if it doesn't matter to you. And this is not on the recipe, but I actually did it the last time I made it. I also put in 2 mashed potatoes that I boiled up first and mashed those into it. And those helped hold the patties together, because as you notice, I'm not using any egg, so these patties are also vegan. And I was really happy with the results of that. So you can also add a mashed potato to this. So, and then for the salsa, you need 3 mangoes diced, 1 red pepper diced, 1 small red onion finely diced, 2 limes juiced, 3 tablespoons fresh cilantro, 1 tablespoon honey, and 1/4 teaspoon salt. And this is enough salsa that we actually have a little bit to eat before the meal, a little bit for leftover, because everybody loves the salsa so much. So you're going to dice up the mangoes, the peppers, and the onions, and put it in a bowl, toss it with the lime juice, the cilantro, honey, and salt, cover it, and just let it sit in the refrigerator while you make the croquettes. So for the croquettes, you're going to saute the onions and olive oil until it's translucent, add the carrots and garlic, then the celery, the peppers, the mushrooms, and continue cooking them until they're soft. Remove them from the heat and put them into a large mixing bowl. Then you're going to puree the black beans in a food processor and add them to the mixing bowl. Add the remaining ingredients, except for the breadcrumbs, and combine them well. Form them into patties. Then place the breadcrumbs into a shallow pan. I usually use a pie plate. And then you're going to press each patty into the breadcrumbs. And one thing that I also use sometimes for my gluten-free breadcrumbs is I just get a box of good quality organic cornflakes. And I puree those, and I use those as the breadcrumbs. And they're really great. They make more of a like a panko flake, because I don't grind them too fine, and then they're really crunchy, and that's nice, too. And I don't fry these. I place them on a well-greased cookie sheet. I mist the top of the patties with some olive oil spray, and I bake them at 375 for 15 minutes, turn them over, and then bake another 10 minutes. And everyone's oven is different. In the middle, you might want to turn the pan around so that the front and the back of the oven cook more evenly. But they're really great just baking in the oven. You don't have to fry them, and the baking really helps them solidify. Once they are baked, these are great burgers that you can, or croquettes that you can put into the freezer and pull out as you need them. They're really great. And that's it. Enjoy them. As always, I'd love feedback, so if you make them, send me a comment on my website. Let me know how you like them. And my website, as I said before, is ieatgreen.com. So enjoy them. And now it's my pleasure to invite on Margaret Brown, who is the National Resource Defense Council's first Food Boss Fellow. And I'll let her tell us what that is. But she works to build a better food system in the New York region, specifically by using legal tools and policy reforms to help sustainable farmers, encourage the development of key regional infrastructure, and she also works on leveraging the power of large institutional purchasers for regional and sustainable food. Margaret gained her personal connection to farming after growing up on her family's own dairy farm in Maryland, and she also spent some time working on an organic farm in Maine. Margaret, are you with us?
I am. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing the work that you do at NRDC.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So first, why don't you just share with us your story, how you became passionate about the food movement and what brought you to NRDC.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have always had a really strong environmental interest, and my dad is an environmental professor. We spent a lot of time outdoors when I was little, and it's always been something I've been really interested in. And so I knew when I went to law school that I wanted to do environmental law. And I took classes in environmental law. And I sort of was struggling.
Did you go to Vermont Law School?
Oh, no. I went to NYU in New York City.
Oh, NYU. Okay.
Although Vermont Law School has a wonderful environmental law program and a lot more environmental law classes.
Right.
While I was at NYU, probably in my second year, I sort of was trying to figure out, I really liked environmental law, but how did I want to use it? And how did I think it would be most effective? And what would be most interesting to me? And I spent a summer doing some sort of more traditional environmental litigation. And I really found it intellectually interesting, but it was really slow moving. Although I'm realizing now everything is slow moving, having had a job, but I hadn't had a job at that point.
Welcome to the real world, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it seemed impossibly slow to me. And at the end of that summer, I went and volunteered on this farm in Maine. And I'd always had an interest in sort of land conservation, which is one of the reasons I was interested in farming. But this is a really beautiful, beautiful farm. But I was just amazed by, on a day-to-day basis, how much they were benefiting the environment and what good care they were taking of this land and how they were providing all this fresh food. It was sort of, I think
Is it
a lot
Ellie
of people,
Coleman's farm?
It was not. It's very near Elliot Coleman's farm, which is also beautiful. Uh-huh. It's called Horsepower Farm. It's probably 30 minutes from there. It's a draft run farm, organic vegetable farm.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of people in the food movement have this, your sort of like aha moment, where mm-hmm. you're like filled with hope and excitement about all the good things we can do for the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to my last year at NYU and I really started trying to, and I graduated in 2011, so the food movement was already certainly far along, but it's come a long time even in those 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So just trying to understand the food movement in New York, and that's how I found NRDC, was just through, and specifically my team at NRDC, through asking questions and wanting to meet with people working on this. So I had an initial meeting where they sort of told me about their food project, which is pretty new, and then I interned a little bit during law school here at NRDC.
Mm-hmm. So what work is NRDC doing right now around the issue of food, and how does your work impact that?
Yeah, we are doing sort of an amazing amount of work around food, actually, and an increasing amount of work. We have a national food and ag program, and we just had our second retreat in Brooklyn with probably 20 staffers working on food in different capacities. We have a lot of staff who works on a campaign and related lawsuit against non-therapeutic antibiotic use in livestock. We have staff that works on food waste. We have people who do more traditional work on pesticides. But the team I work on is New York-based, and we work on sort of a more systems approach around the idea of establishing or reestablishing a working regional sustainable food system around the New York area.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that in a couple ways, but we try to, you know, help farmers, strengthen distribution infrastructure, and also use the purchasing power of city or state or large institutions to build demand for local food.
Mm-hmm. Can you just backtrack a little for some of my listeners? They might not really know what you mean when you say a regional food system. What does that mean, and why is that an important part of reforming our food system?
Yeah, so I think people for a long time have sort of tried to figure out how do we define this, right? What does local mean? What exactly is a regional food system? We all, at least I get this like good fuzzy feeling from it, but what does it mean? And I think we're sort of realizing that it means a system where when we can, we grow food near where we eat it, where people mm-hmm. can connect to their food and where it can be distributed in an efficient way. So in New York, we have a lot of people, obviously. So our region might be bigger than a small town in a place that produces a lot of food year-round. So in our work, we went up to Vermont recently and met with people there. That's, I think, part of our regional food system.
So it's like the Northeast.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that fits in, obviously, to a national food system where sometimes we can't grow stuff in the Northeast. I'm vegetarian, so it's pretty hard to eat vegetarian year-round on the Northeast, in the Northeast.
Right.
Impossible, but...
Using local food. It's possible
to do it
because we go outside of our region.
Exactly.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I think the reason we think it's so important is that it really connects people to their food, and when people connect with their food, they make better choices about how it's grown. When you start to really understand how your food is produced, you're more likely to choose organic or talk to your farmer about their growing practices. And I think it also has the power to draw a lot of people into the broader environmental movement
mm-hmm.
because people really connect around the issue of food.
Right.
It can be sort of a gateway issue for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's why one of the reasons I love food so much, because it does connect all of the different issues around food, around environment, around health, mm-hmm. around sustainability. I mean, it's all connected.
Absolutely.
Around food.
Yeah.
So what kind of work are you doing to build up that regional food system, and how do you see it changing over the next 5 years?
Yeah, I think it feels to me like another reason I think regional food systems are great is that there's a lot of energy around it at the local level that there may not be necessarily in Washington around good food and sustainable food. And I think, so we've seen that people, leaders in New York, politicians, are excited about this idea. They see it as a local economic development issue. They also see it as a health issue, all these things you mentioned. So one example of a way that I think a response we've been really excited about is we work some with the New York City Department of Education on helping to improve school food here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And they just were really responsive to the idea of getting better food into the schools, despite a whole host of constraints that I'm sure you're very familiar with given mm-hmm. your work in schools. But really limited funding, a lot of regulations. Logistically, there are 1,200 schools in New York City.
Right. New York City alone has 1 million students.
Yes.
So you think of, you want to offer, I remember talking to the director of the food service program of New York City Public Schools, and he was just saying, they were thrilled that they got peaches, local peaches into the school. But, they wiped out a whole farmer's crop. I mean, they needed 1 million,
yeah,
1 million
exactly.
peaches to serve peaches to the students. And, that's a lot of peaches.
It is, yeah. So it's an amazing way to make change when New York City schools asks for better food. It sends a signal to the market, whether they ask for it from New York farmers, which we think is fantastic and hope that they can do more and more, and they've done some, but if they ask for it on a national market, it's still great. And it has a huge impact in, health of our kids. Especially here in New York City, most of the kids are eligible for free or reduced price meals, and most of those students get, 50% of their daily calories from a school meal. So it's significant from a health standpoint. It also helps to set patterns and help kids learn about eating healthy and protecting the environment and all these things. So we see schools as this amazing opportunity or lever for change
mm-hmm.
in the market and in society.
Absolutely, because there was always a disconnect. Something that I always struggled with, where they might, come from health class and learn about healthier eating, and then they go to the cafeteria and that's not what they're being served. And there was just, they were just missing an opportunity. I mean, the cafeteria should be role modeling
mm-hmm.
what we're talking about when we're trying to teach them about health and healthy eating. And if it's, promoting the foods that are making them sick, it's just a real contradiction to what we want to do.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the Urban School Food Alliance that is forming, that's really hopefully going to help facilitate some of these changes.
Okay, great.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right, so everyone who's listening, don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back. I'm speaking with Margaret Brown from the Natural Resource Defense Council. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Margaret Brown, the first Food Law Fellow at the Natural Resource Defense Council. And NRDC is an organization that I look to a lot to let me know many of the important issues that I really want to share with all of you. So I'm really thrilled to have her on. Margaret, are you with us?
I am. Thanks.
Sure. So when we took the break, I was saying I wanted you to tell us a little bit about the Urban School Food Alliance, what that is and how that is an alliance that is really going to help to make some change happen for our kids.
Yeah, so the Urban School Food Alliance is, I think, really, really exciting. It's a alliance of six of the largest school districts in the country, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, Miami, and Orlando. And the idea is that they would come together on purchasing of food or food service items to bring down the cost of sustainable items. They have an enormous purchasing power. As you mentioned, New York City has 1 million kids and is the second largest server of institutional meals in the U.S. after the Department of Defense, which is unbelievable. But this school district has, I mean, this alliance together has 3 million kids, and every year they spend $530 million on food service items and food, which is amazing. So just sort of as I was saying about New York City and the power to make change in the marketplace with these large purchases, I think the alliance does that, you know, several fold. So the idea, as I said, is they want to bulk, bring together their purchasing power. They basically make the same request for items, and that it's going to make these better items cheaper. So the best example and the first thing that they're working on are compostable trays. In New York City, for instance, we currently, at the vast, vast majority, except a few pilot schools, every lunch is served in a styrofoam tray, 270 million styrofoam trays a year.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But they're very, very cheap, and a lot of our schools are no longer equipped with washing facilities. So that's New York City, and many other school districts have used these for a long time. They're obviously horrible. Styrofoam, the creation of styrofoam is really bad for the environment. And styrofoam is the, like, the brand name. It's polystyrene is the actual material. But the creation is really, has really negative environmental impacts, and is also a huge solid waste burden of sending all of those.
Doesn't something leach from the styrofoam also into the food? Because I know, you know, if I order a coffee and it comes in a, I won't even get coffee anymore in a styrofoam, because it actually changes the flavor, the taste. You know, something leaches off of the styrofoam into the coffee, and I don't know what it is, but it can't be good.
Yeah, I think it's definitely getting our food away from this is like a really certainly a positive turn in the right direction. So. So the kids eat on the tray, right, and then they throw the whole tray in the trash, and all of that has to go into a landfill.
Right, and something I don't think all my listeners realize is that they've done away with plates. I mean, this is the thing that blew me away when I went and visited the schools. They don't have plates. They put the food directly on the tray.
Yeah, so, that's a good point.
You know, so the kids are throwing away the tray, but it just, to me, it's so horrible to eat right on your tray. It just feels like grub instead of being plated food. You know, is there any way they can think about bringing back plates? Or
I think that's a really good point, and one that not a lot of people think about, and that I certainly didn't think about until we did like a visit of some schools, and until we talked to about school food, is one of the things they're really looking for as they search for a compostable tray is a round tray. So that it still has little compartments, sort of, so like the kids can put their milk someplace and whatever, but it feels, or at least they feel, that it's going to feel more like a normal dining experience, so that we can get kids back to the idea of sitting and eating, and that it reminds you of when you eat at home, and sort of the whole idea of establishing the right patterns. So I think that is something that they're looking into as they look for the compostable tray. And then, yeah, and then the final thing on the trays is just that now in New York City we're exploring the idea of citywide composting, or at least they're starting to look at it, and there will be composting in some buildings around Manhattan and possibly in some schools. So now when the kids throw out the tray with any leftover food, it can be composted instead of sent directly to a landfill, which is a real significant change. I think New York City, our compost stream is, I mean, our waste stream is in like 17% organics.
Mm-hmm.
Enormous loss of nutrients that we're burying in the ground when we could be composting them and sending
right.
it back out to farms.
Mm-hmm. But what about meat and things like that in the compost? Like usually when we're doing compost, you know, we're doing no animal products in our compost.
Yeah.
Do they have to separate that out, or this would just compost everything?
I think it composts everything. I'm mm-hmm. not exactly an expert on the technology, but I think it's something about it's different than like sort of the compost like I drop off at the green market or something. It's done in a different way that
right industrial composting.
Yeah.
Right. Because I know a lot of those, you know, the cornstarch compostable things. You know, they say that they're really not okay to just throw in your regular compost. You're really supposed to put it into a commercial composting.
Yeah.
Situation.
And that's something we worked really closely with them on, is making sure that we have some people who do compost, compostable things in stadiums around the country, and so they
mm-hmm.
sort of deal with it in the same way, and making sure that they're using a compostable product that really breaks down in the way that it needs to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of their first
So is this
project.
Food Alliance only purchasing non-perishable products, you know, using their buying power for non-perishable products, or are they also trying to use it for food items? Because food items, you know, if you're talking about regional, obviously these schools are all around the country,
mm-hmm.
L.A. and
yeah.
New York and Miami. So
yeah.
that wouldn't be helpful in purchasing regional food, would it?
No, it's not really. And like the trays, for instance, wouldn't be produced regionally. It doesn't really
right.
make sense. Sort of
mm-hmm.
against the point. And the next thing that the Alliance is looking at is antibiotic-free chicken, which has been, which a lot of people have done a lot of work on. School Food Focus has worked a lot on it. They had some success in Chicago. And in the Chicago example, Chicago buys antibiotic-free drumsticks and serves them a couple times a year, I believe, in their public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Those are actually regional farms. In the case of the Urban School Food Alliance here, they'll put out one big request that could come from, like, regional distribution centers from larger purchasers,
mm-hmm.
but producers. It could not. I think for instance, here in New York, we don't really produce a lot of chicken,
mm-hmm.
so we wouldn't necessarily buy our chicken locally anyway. I think
right.
what it does do for regional food is like get the conversation started, and as people have success in this, and when they have success in the trays, and hopefully the chicken, they're excited about the fact that they can find reasonably priced sustainable foods. It also reduces; they don't have to pay extra for the trays. Hopefully, they can pay extra for something else, like New York apples or. New York City actually buys some yogurt from Stonyfield
mm-hmm.
Within our region. So I think we are trying to sort of, we see a link between the conversation on sustainable food and the conversation on regional food.
Mm-hmm.
I just
now, I have
food.
A question. When you mentioned that Chicago, you know, four times a year they served the antibiotic-free chicken, does that mean that they only serve chicken four times a year, or all the other times they serve chicken with antibiotics?
I'm not sure that it's four times a year. I think it's a certain number, and maybe once or twice a month, actually. But they do serve, I believe, conventional chicken.
Right, the rest of the time is conventional. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's maybe what they'll need to do in these other districts as well, if they're able to, because the price on antibiotic-free chicken is higher. And also a lot of the chicken that comes into schools, a lot of the cheese, a lot of the beef is through the USDA Commodities Program, is effectively
right.
a donation from the government.
Right.
So
yeah.
spending any money on it is a burden to the schools,
mm-hmm.
certainly. So they're really incentivizing these better foods. I mean, prioritizing, excuse me.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I'm excited about, like even when I hear McDonald's, which I, you know, can't stand, when I hear that they want to start serving chicken that's antibiotic-free or hormone-free, the excitement it gets me is just that as more and more people are put demands for this, more retailers and producers are going to be putting that pressure on the suppliers, and more farmers hopefully will start transitioning to this. Although we need to get our farm bill to help in that transition, which it's not really, you know. We need to help transition these farmers away from these practices that are not benefiting us and transition into, you know, antibiotic-free, hormone-free chicken. Also, you know, from, I know you're vegetarian too, but trying to get the kids to eat less and serve more plant-based foods, that the need for so much quantity is reduced.
I think that's true also, and we have, and I think in some ways schools are making that, are doing that already, right? On a day that they serve antibiotic-free chicken, their meal is going to be over the cost that the meal should be for the day probably, and it means that another meal is going to need to, like, make up the cost on that, and that often is a meal that's more plant-based just because it's cheaper. We also have in New York City an entirely vegetarian school.
I know, it's great.
Really exciting. Although I don't know that that would work for all locations, but it seems to be working for them. It's really exciting, and we also have this alternative menu that schools can adopt that's significantly more plant-based.
Right.
That's an interesting option.
Yeah, the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food is really working with the vegetarian school and was, you know, very involved in getting that set up.
Yeah, they've done a great job.
But, you know, that's a really exciting thought. I mean, if we could transition more schools to doing, you know, not just meat this Monday, but, you know, few days a week of no meat. I mean, with so many kids, think of the impact that that would have on the pressure on the environment and on their costs.
Mm-hmm.
Could be
yeah.
really great. Now, one thing I remember when I was talking to the gentleman who runs the New York City School of Food Program, he was saying their biggest challenge in purchasing regional food is that there's no local processing plants for processing the foods. Is NRDC working on that at all? You know, like he said, they could get local potatoes, but they don't have the staff to wash and scrub the potatoes. So they want to purchase potatoes that are already, you know, that are, processed when they were in season and then flash frozen, and they want to buy them, you know, as frozen French fries or frozen roasted potatoes or whatever.
Yeah, that's a real barrier, I think, to getting this kind of food into the schools. And the food that New York City buys locally already sort of reflects that. They buy local apples, right, which don't need to be processed in any way.
Mm-hmm.
They buy local milk, and they buy local yogurt, both of which have existing processing capacity because dairy is such a major industry here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of that capacity has existed historically. On other things, that we have some sort of small processing places in the region, but they're, I don't know that they could do the size of New York City School of Food, and I don't think that they would be price competitive with a larger processor that you would find. Like if you bought something from California and it was processed in California in a massive plant.
I'm thinking, you know, especially seasonal, you know, because like you said, you know, we don't grow fresh greens year-round. And so in season, a lot of the time that kids are in school, you're dealing with winter vegetables, root vegetables, and they take labor to make them happen, you know. All the squashes, they need to be, you know, usually peeled, you know, scrubbed, peeled, chopped, and they're, you know, hard to cut. And so they're time consuming, and so when you know, that's why so many people buy that already cut butternut squash in the market.
Yeah.
You know,
butternut squash is very hard to cut.
Right, just to save that step. You know, so for the schools to be able to use it, they're going to need to get it in that kind of way as well. And so I'm just saying that I think we need to look at helping to create more processing plants for this.
I definitely agree, and I hope that and think that the as like sort of demand from New York City School of Food and other large purchasers in the region develops for local food, that the market will in some ways fill that need for processing. The other thing that we are working on that I think is a piece of the same puzzle is better wholesale distribution. So that, like, a lot of places that buy local food, restaurants and individual consumers go to the farmer's market and buy, you know, sometimes you see at Union Square these, like, people buying, like, bushels of things, even from Union Square for their restaurant. We really want to be able to build on our farmer's market success and get food, regional food, sustainable food into the, like, wholesale distribution stream. So that you could, instead of having to go to the farmer's market to get a New York apple, you could go to your bodega or you could go to your Met Foods or whatever and find that same stuff so that more people can access it. And so to do that, we've been pushing on advocating for a wholesale farmer's market to be part of the modernization of the Hunts Point produce facility.
What, so there'd be a separate section that would be more organic foods?
It would be regional food, both organic and not. So it, basically the idea would be when they modernize Hunts Point, which they need to do at some point over the course of the next couple of years, it's an enormous market. It serves 22 million Americans every day. And only 4% of the food coming through Hunts Point is from New York farms. Traditionally, New York farmers, regional farmers have had a hard time getting into the market. And if we... we want to figure out a way to give regional farms a place to sell at Hunts Point so that they can get more food into the distribution stream and get it out to more people at a lower price.
And is that something that's good for the farmers, too? I mean, do they, you know, I always think of the farmer's market as a place that you can go directly to the farm and you're cutting out the middleman so that, you know, usually a restaurant's not paying, who goes to the farmer's market, has prearranged with the farmer.
Yeah.
They're not paying the same price as the regular consumer that's just shopping there. They've made an arrangement. They're coming to pick up the bushel, and they're going directly from the farmer to the restaurant and cutting out that middleman. If there's a, if they first have to go through another middle person, doesn't that end up shortchanging somebody? Either the farmer has to take less or the restaurant owner has to pay more.
I think it's a different kind of farm, really, that benefits from the wholesale distribution stream. It's the farmers who are at a, selling at a much larger scale or that don't have the time to drive 4 hours into New York City and sit at the farmer's market all day. So I think it's these sort of like farms in the middle that we had for a long time and that we're losing that really benefit. And those farms are important parts of our rural economies, just the way small, sort of more picturesque farms are. But I think
I don't see a benefit to buying regional food if you're buying regional sprayed pesticide, herbicide food.
My
thing is, you know, regional. I want regional food that's organic. You know, that's what I want to promote and help support. So, you know, if you fill it with the farmers that are so big that they're just selling the same old, same status quo, sprayed, machine-farmed food, then just because it's local does not really mean it's going to be better.
I absolutely agree. I think we need to, on all these things, you need to be careful and talk about growing practices, but there are a lot of farms in the region that are careful about whether or not they're organic.
Right. They don't have to be labeled. You know, I'm not a stickler for, you know, going through the rigmarole to make yourself, you know, to get that certification. It's more look me in the eye and tell me I'm doing it right. I'm not spraying. I'm using organic seed. I'm, you know.
And that's a lot easier at a farmer's market, I agree. As we sort of build up this regional food system and it becomes and isn't always as face-to-face, we need to be sure to talk about and sort of wrap in sustainability standards for that food.
Anyway, Margaret, we're just about out of time. And before we go, I want to make sure we have enough time for you to share with everybody NRDC's website and how they'd find out more information about the work you're doing.
Absolutely. So NRDC's website is www.nrdc.org. We also have a Facebook page and a Twitter. And for food issues, you can follow us at NRDC Food and also at NRDC New York, both of which talk about our food work nationally and regionally.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's really important. I'm really excited about the Urban School Food Alliance. I think that has some great potential. And definitely push for the idea of plates. It makes me crazy. I just feel like there are cattle walking through the food line just getting, you know, mush on their plate. It's just terrible. So I'd love to see kids have plates again.
Absolutely.
Get them old-fashioned that way, but I like that. Anyway, thank you, Margaret, so much for joining me, and thank you for the work you're doing. And everybody out there listening, thank you for joining us and listening, and have a great rest of the week.
Thanks.
Bye
so
for now.